Well, it turns out that if you listen closely to the wild and driving electro-industrial multinational rhythms of the music of my guest today on the program, you'll hear the unmistakable deep and percussive heartbeat of Long Island. Yeah, I was surprised too, but it's there. I'm Alex Green, and this is Stereo Embers, the podcast. Check this out. Music of KMFDM, a band which features my guest today on the program, Lucia Ceffarelli. Let me tell you a little bit about KMFDM and Lucia Ceffarelli. Formed by Brain Trust Sasha Konietzko in Germany and Paris in 1984, KMFDM got their start as a performance art project, but it didn't take long for their propulsive industrial rhythms to establish them as one of the most dynamic bands around. Over the course of their winning career, they've toured the world, sold millions of records, and unleashed an uninterrupted string of classic albums like 1986's What Do You Know About Deutschland, 1990's Naive, 2002's Attack, and their brilliant new one, Let Go. KMFDM's albums are always a blast of unbridled energy, and Let Go is no exception. It's a dynamic blend of crunchy electronica, cascading metal riffs and lashing industrial beats, all combining to make one of the most ferociously danceable albums of 2024. Now, as far as branding consistency goes, it gets no better than KMFDM, whose unmistakable and inimitable sleeves have been done by artist Aiden Brute Hughes, whose work perfectly captures the ferocious energy and the belief system of the band. And what of that belief system, you might be asking yourself? Well, let's just say this. It's a continued railing against oppression, censorship, war, and violence. Not a bad list of things to rail against at all. Now, KMFDM are really a musical collective, so they've had a revolving door of members throughout the years. The Long Island-born singer Lucia Ceffarelli joined the band in 2002, and close to 25 years later, she's still there. Married to Konietzko, the two have forged an enduring creative and romantic partnership. A vocalist of tremendous power and range, Ceffarelli was the former singer of Drill, whose lone album for A&M in the 90s was one I listened to a lot. And like 20 minutes before the interview started, one of our researchers here told me about Ceffarelli being in Drill, which I didn't know, and it kind of blew my mind. So if I keep coming back to Drill in the interview, it's because I was wondering what happened to the band Drill, and then that piece fell together, and I got really excited. So I bring it up a lot. You know, I love that band, and I was wondering, you know, what happened to them, and well, the answer came, and right before the interview started, and I got really enthusiastic. I get that way. Now, Ceffarelli is one of those performers who was put on this planet with instant artistic force. She sings with muscle and finesse, and like a great baseball pitcher, the best way to describe her is someone who's got the stuff. Turns out she's also awesome to talk to. So let's get to it. Me and Lucia Ceffarelli of KMFDM, right here on Stereo Embers, the podcast.
Thank you.
fan of the Drill album. I was writing for all these magazines in the 90s, and A&M would send the advances, and I had the soft cover of it. But
Well, this means so much to me. You have no idea, because I meet so few people that know about that band. So this is exciting.
I love that band. And I was waiting for the follow-up, and I guess just it never came out, right? That never...
Well, there was a follow-up. There was a follow-up. And, we got lost in the shuffle when that whole major label reshuffle happened, you know, the consolidation of labels when A&M was absorbed into Interscope, I believe it was.
Interscope? Right.
I don't remember exactly what happened, but there was a big consolidation of labels, and, you know, we didn't have the numbers to justify them keeping us on, so they never released the follow-up album. But I'll tell you right now, I actually listened to that album recently, and although I love the material, the mixes weren't so good. They weren't so good. So if it ever does come out again on some label, I would love to have it redone. Are you a longtime KMFDM fan?
Long time. I got into KMFDM before I got into Drill, obviously. And I hadn't made that connection. So it's a cool connection to make. Working in college radio in the late 80s, the KMFDM stuff would come. And it was like from another planet. And so, you know, it was like, whoa, this is like a thing. And I don't think I understood conceptually the art project side of it. I took it very literally because I was 18. I didn't quite get the whole scope of it. What about you? Were you in on the band? Like,
you know what? When I was in high school, there was a girl in my class that was wearing a KMFDM t-shirt. And I was like, who's that band? And of course, you know, and I think about these things now because you realize how life works and synchronicity and all these odd little connections that are always happening along the way. And then you look back and thread them all together. It was years later when I was in Drill and I was playing in Seattle with a band that Sasha was working with. I was opening for Sister Machine Gun. I don't know if you remember that band.
Sure.
He was their publisher, and he was at that show and he saw Drill perform. And then years later, when he was working on MDFMK with Tim Scold, he remembered me and reached out. So it was just, you know, this trail of KMFDM kind of following me along on my journey until we finally met, you know. And I was not aware of the impact that they had in this. I mean, Drill was a part of this scene, and I wasn't even really aware of KMFDM, so I feel a little ignorant and foolish in that respect. But I caught on pretty quick, and, you know, joining KMFDM was truly like my musical emancipation, because it was this opportunity for me to explore my craft in ways I never had before.
I think that's the thing, is that in terms of the scope of KMFDM, there's a lot of room. When I was 18, I thought it was a narrow lane because my brain was sort of working like that, like, oh, this is just an industrial thing. And it's like, sure, but it's the palette is so wide and the sonic possibilities are manifold.
Well, I'm glad that you recognize that, because when I hear the term industrial, or when Sasha hears the term industrial, it feels, you know, it's deflating in a way, because the spectrum is so wide and our musical tastes are massive. So we incorporate a lot of different styles, thus the ultra heavy beat, right?
Well, but you remember growing up in the 80s, the reflex, you're right, it's a reductive term, but in those days it was so polarized. It was sort of like, he's metal, she's goth, that's industrial, that's college rock. And you had to almost plant your flag somewhere.
it's still kind of like that, isn't it? I mean, I think that people like to put you in a box and keep you there. And that's challenging for artists like us who are always evolving from record to record and incorporating different sounds and on the same record, right? So you have a song like Airhead sitting next to a song like, you know, Next Move or the Erl Koenig. And like, what the fuck?
Right.
But it makes
sense. Right. It does. And I think that's sort of the idea of wanting to put everything in a box. As you get older, you realize how limiting that really is. And also, it isn't fair to the artist because it's sort of like, an artist does so much. And KMFDM, out of all the bands that were grouped as quote unquote industrial, I realize now at the ripe old age of 107.
Are you aging yourself in dog years?
Yeah, that's right. In rock and roll years, I realize now just how adventurous the band really is. And it's sort of like, reverse engineering and going back and listening to the early records, it's like, oh, there was a lot going on I missed at 18.
Yeah, but you can be forgiven for that because you were a whole teenager and you had other things on your mind.
Oh, yes, I did. Up until I was about 48. Then clarity hit. I would love it to see you at your high school reunion and that girl is there. And she's like, hey, you know, you're like, hey, what have you been up to? And she's like, oh, I'm a podiatrist or whatever. Then she says, what about you? And you say, oh, remember that shirt, that KMFDM shirt you wore? Yeah, I married the singer. It's so funny.
Yeah, I mean, how life works out. It's crazy.
It's crazy. What about for you? I mean, in terms of your own musical chops, like, what are you doing every day to keep it sharp? And do you need to do stuff every day? And if you don't, do you feel weird? That's three questions. But I mean, where are you in terms of like everyday routine with musicality? And I ask because a lot of young people listen to the show, and I think it's important for them to hear how someone who's been in the industry for a while approaches discipline.
I'm so glad that you asked this question because nobody ever asked me about this, but the way that I structure my day and the way I have always structured my time in regards to my life, everything is structured around music. You know, whether when I had a job, a day job, I woke up in the morning before I went to work, I went to the gym, then I went to work. Then after work, I would take my voice lessons. If I didn't have a voice lesson, I would be doing songwriting sessions with other songwriters or recording demos. When I was in a band, it was about making sure that I did my vocalese and I learned the material and I would rehearse. Now, you know, just to give you a glimpse of the last years, it's just we wake up, Sasha goes into the studio. I am either noodling around writing songs on my own or working on something that we're doing together in a band. I'm working on my voice. I go to the gym. I spend a lot of time outside and I'm reading a lot, you know, what's going on in the news, in the world, or some poetry and melodies. I'm always working on melodies. I have always had a love for songwriting. So I challenge myself by trying to come up with melodies and lyrics to the sound of rain hitting the window, or, you know, I approach my craft probably the way mathematicians approach coming up with new ways of figuring out equations. I'm not educated in music the way most of my compatriots in the greater scheme of the business. You know, Andy Black Sugar is a very highly educated musician in his instrument and has studied in schools. And I'm not like that. I started when I was in high school just working with other songwriters in Manhattan and other musicians and just doing it over and over again and challenging myself, studying opera, studying pop, working with rock vocal coaches and just pounding it out on the road year after year after year after year. And it's kind of, I eat, live, breathe, and sleep music. That's my life. And I love it. You know, we have a family, we have a daughter, a dog, and we incorporate that whole thing into what we do. And, you know, you have to dedicate yourself to the craft if you're serious about doing it. I know so many talented, talented people that I don't think they live, eat, and sleep it in the same way that I do, because they're able to just go off and do other things and leave it behind and move into other careers. But for me, it's been such a passionate part of my life that I dedicate a great part of my daily existence to it.
Your brain is always in sort of geared towards art, even when you're at the gym, even when you're making breakfast. There's a rhythmic element to your thought process.
Yeah, I walk down the street and my neighbors say, "Take off those headphones. You know, you're not approachable." And I say, I'm not trying. It's not that I don't want to be approachable. I'm busy. I'm working on something. I'm always working on something. I'm writing. I'm conceptualizing. And I'm very, very blessed to be able to spend my time and my days doing this. And I realize that. So I'm super grateful that I'm in the place that I am, because this is my happy place.
Were you always a disciplined person, even as a young woman? With Drill, like that album, to me, it's like, that's somebody who's committed. Like, that's a committed album. There's nothing halfway about that record, which might be why it appealed to me so much. There's a kind of feral investment in the music.
I am a little feral, but there's a story behind that too.
Let's get to you being feral. I want to hear about you as you sip tea. I want to hear how you're feral. So I guess what I'm trying to figure out is this who you've always been? Or you didn't grow into discipline. You were always driven.
I was driven because I wanted to get out of my house. I came from a very abusive household. And my refuge was hiding out in the bathroom, listening to the radio. And I would hide in trees in my yard and just like scribble words down and form them into rhythmic prose. I always wrote and heard rhythms to them. And I remember at a very young age sitting in my, I don't know, maybe it was fourth grade, third grade. We had to, you know, when your teacher would call on you and ask you to read from aloud from a book. Mm-hmm. And it was a poem, and I was reading it in the rhythm of a poem, but I had never read a poem before. And my teacher asked me, does your parents read poetry to you at home? And I said, no. She said, you have a very natural rhythm to the way that you're reading that. And I didn't really understand it, but it's when I would write, I would hear melodies. And I discovered at a very early age that I loved it. I loved words. I loved rhythms. I loved melodies. And I loved MTV when I saw it. And I saw these bigger than life characters jumping out of the screen. And I thought, that's the life for me. You know, foolishly thinking that it would be easy to get there as a kid. You see this and you're like, I'm going to be a rock star. I had no idea how punishing the journey would be. Mm. It's been absolutely punishing. But I wanted to get out of the house and away from that. And I understood rage and I understood pain. My sister, when I was a teenager, well, not a teenager, when I was in my early 20s, she was diagnosed with HIV. So you know, between the violence that I was exposed to in my early years and then my favorite sister being diagnosed with HIV and going through that journey with her, I had a lot of rage and pain, and I knew how to get in touch with it. And that's what you heard in that first album. I was channeling a lot of just primal screams were coming out of me, and I didn't even know I could do it before I got behind the mic. It was one day I was in the hospital and I had to administer some tubing into an outlet that was surgically inserted into my sister's chest. And then the next hours later, I was in the studio and I just completely freaked out behind the mic. And Dan was recording me and he played it back for me the next day. And he was like, "Can you do that again?" I was like, "I don't know." And then I did again and again and again, and I never stopped. There's a lot of substance behind what I'm doing. It's not, yes, I had vocal lessons from a very early age. I'm a stylist. I'm not some diva singer. That's clear, right? We all can recognize that. But there is some training and a lot of substance behind what I'm doing. And I tried to be as intentional as I can about the subject matter that I'm singing about. I'm not writing, I hope not to deliver fluff. You know, I want to move people and connect, be a mirror for others.
And I think that's what really got me about Drill, is that the authenticity of the delivery, the sincerity of the sound, which, by the way, I put it on a few days ago and it's still there. Like it's not a dated album. Like it doesn't fall anywhere on a timeline, which I think is really a testament to the authenticity that I'm talking about. And I just, it's so fun to be able to tell you how much I love that album, because I've always wondered whatever happened to Drill, and now I know. But The Girl in the Tree is a beautiful and also heartbreaking moment, because it's heartbreaking for the sadness and the pain, but it's beautiful in the sense that you realized early on that art is a refuge. Art will save you and art will take care of you. Like what Paul Simon, you know, which has nothing to do with Drill or KMFDM, but "I've got my books and my poetry to protect me."
Yes. Right? Yes. And it has saved my life. And that's why I'm actually attempting to do something that I've never done before. And I'm scared shitless about it, because if I fail, it's going to be heartbreaking for me. But while we were making this KMFDM record, I was simultaneously writing my next solo album, which I decided, in order to kind of challenge myself as a writer, I would write it myself. And I'm not really a player, but I've been teaching myself how to play guitar and using GarageBand. And I wrote a record, and along the way, my manager talked me into initiating a Kickstarter campaign. So I'm going to do this Kickstarter campaign. I want to mention this here in case any of your readers happen to be listening to this and want to support me on it. And I'm going to kick that off and hopefully be able to raise enough money to make my third solo album, because there's messaging in that that's a little bit more personal. And, you know, as I told you, I'm writing all the time, and I would like to do this, what is ad infinitum? Is that the word? You know, I want to do this continually into the future, and I need to come up with more creative ways of raising capital, because, you know, it's getting more and more challenging for artists like us to get records made these days.
On that subject, back in the 80s and early 90s, bands like KMFDM or whoever seemed to always be passing through town. It just seemed like if you missed them, you'll get them again in a couple of months or a year. And sure enough, they pass right through. Travel is so much harder now than it used to be, isn't it? It's more expensive and it's a real concern. It's not as simple as like, hey, get in the van, Henry Rollins style, and just drive across the country and sleep on people's floors and whatever. Being a little bit older, that's less appealing. But also it's a big affair. It's a big production to go on the road, right?
Yeah. I mean, just 10 minutes before I joined you here on Zoom, we were going over more logistical challenges that we have to deal with. And it's very expensive. This is not an acoustic set that people are coming to see. There's right. a lot moving parts to this whole thing. And it is a very expensive undertaking. And, you know, one of the reasons we had to unfortunately cancel our last European tour was because during COVID, all the prices went haywire and it just became unsustainable. Thank God, you know, we're still in a position where we were able to do it in America because we love it. I mean, I love being on stage. I love it. I hope that you and the audiences that come to the shows can feel that energy because we really love it.
It's very clear that you do and everyone in the band does. And it must be, in order to come to San Francisco, like you're coming, like, you know, in order to tour the US in the way that you are, it has to first be deemed that it's worth your time. It's always worth your time to be on stage, but it's, you know, traveling is a big thing. So you must have to crunch numbers in a way that you maybe didn't used to have to as much.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Sasha is the budget end of things. He works the budgets. He's super smart, experienced. He's been doing this for a very, very long time. And he generally arrives at the right numbers, but there's any number of things that can go wrong, that have gone wrong. You know, if you don't, if you don't sell enough merch, then you don't get paid what you need. There's been losses. I mean, in Europe, we have done tours where, you know, he's paid the band and he never got paid just in order to get everybody out on the road to make some money and to support a new release. It's very challenging. And, you know, we're not in a position where we get a whole lot of album promotion. It's primarily word of mouth. So we do what we can. Touring, it's an old school model, but it still works for us. It's incredibly important. We don't have a big machine throwing our, you know, forcing it down the public's throat. It's really word of mouth. And, you know, we're grateful that we still have an audience that knows about us.
Well, I mean, to be fair, I mean, KMFDM is a brand. I mean, in terms of, I know that sounds, again, reductive, but I mean it in the opposite way, that KMFDM is a recognizable brand in terms of having its lane, having its recognition in terms of seeing the band name and knowing exactly what it is. Mm-hmm. So the idea, the notion of establishing oneself is you don't have to worry about that. So that's kind of cool. And I feel like your fans, like at the last show I was at, it was like, oh, the fans stayed with this band. Like, you know, there were young fans there as well, which is really cool. But also I saw people that were my age and it was like, oh, you've been in it with, you know, from the very start, which is pretty cool.
It's a fun audience because of that, because we are interestingly enough, bringing in the younger fans while holding on to the older ones.
Right.
So you have this cross section of people converging to the ultra heavy beat. And that's super exciting for us to see. I mean, there's nothing more exciting than on the last tour, we played Freak Flag for the first time in a long time. And there were little girls, you know, they looked pretty young, and they were just sitting there staring up at the stage, and they knew every word. They were singing along, and I thought, wow, it comes around again. The messages, they're important and they're timeless, and hopefully more and more younger people catch on to it, because it's inspiring music and lyrics, and you know, we're trying to get people to think for themselves, be independent thinkers, and have courage and be fierce and fearless in their lives and their choices, and have a good time.
KMFDM is, in terms sonically and visually, it's own thing. It's its own brand. Does that make it easier for you, for your own solo work, to go, well, that's clearly That's something else. The distinction is very clear with what you're doing and what the band is doing.
You know, my process when I write is the same whether I'm writing for KMFDM or myself. I'm interested in finding the fiercest melody and lyric that I can. Perhaps my style, the vocal style that I use, is definitely different with KMFDM, because when I get handed a song like When the Bell Tolls, for instance, off the new record, that's certainly not something, you know, the music starts with Sasha in KMFDM always. So he is creating the frequency in which we all operate. Yeah. So I'm operating on, when I hear a piece of music, it immediately hits me in the face and I know what I'm going to do, whether it's Airhead or When the Bell Tolls, it's already written. I just have to find my way through it. Mm-hmm. It's different, right? My solo stuff, because I have to be the starting point of the music. That's what makes it different. Sasha is not the starting point of the music. And we decided that together when we recorded IMI. He said, look, if we're going to make a record together for you, you're going to need to be the starting point of the music. You're going to have to figure that out, because it will sound like KMFDM if I am the starting point. So I opened GarageBand, and as I told you earlier, I walk around the street and I create melodies from raindrops. I figured if I can get a drum beat and play a couple of chords, I can write a song. I mean, write a song off of three chords, right?
Sure. So yeah,
I just started noodling around, and I started writing the music on my last solo album. I did do collaborations, but none of that music started with Sasha, and that was intentional to avoid this comparison, which, you know, inevitably you're going to get, right? Because we're in a band together all this time. It's inevitable, but I think we did a really good job of showcasing what I have to offer as a solo artist.
And I guess what it gives you is it gives you a kind of artistic cross training. The two together just gives you more muscle, I think, as an artist.
Yes. And that is my desire, is to, you know, let me just say, I'm surrounded by very talented people. So that is a motivating factor to keep up, you know, and not get lax. I love what I do, and I'm always challenging myself. But Sasha is incredibly prolific. So he's always creating music. I mean, he starts his day, he goes up in the studio. I start my day, and I have to first go to the gym and kind of get everything moving, and then I get to work. But the longer that we work together, the more prolific I find that I'm becoming, because there are no boundaries. He's the first person I ever worked with that said to me, do whatever you want. You got to give zero fucks. Take it as far as you want to go. Just be free. I love my band Drill, but when I was in Drill and when I was signed to a record company and when I had all of these moving parts around me, lots of different voices, I felt like, oh my God, you know, I got to be this, I got to be that. You need to be more like this. You need to be more like that. It was very noisy for someone like me because I think a lot. So it was just, everything just became very buzzy. And then when I joined KMFDM, it's like, my musical world just opened up. And he inspired me. So, you know, I want to be really great at what I do. So I work hard at it.
I remember the publicist telling me, oh, I sent you the Drill record and it's like Hole. And I listened to it and I thought, no, it's nothing like Hole. I don't know what you're talking about. Not even close.
Thank you. But I live for love.
Yeah. But I get the sort of lazy impulse at the time, because that's what people, those associations, but nothing like it at all. And I'm wondering, it was a very fertile moment in music history. And at that point, the pond was pretty stocked with very, you know, emergent, formidable talent. Were you competitive with those emerging people? Or were you just competitive with yourself? And I mean, I guess what I'm really asking is, were you aware of who was around you? And were you watching them?
I think all younger people do that when you're starting out. You're watching everybody else and you're wondering, and you're hearing things too, like, oh, she, you know, at that time people were, somebody compared me to, what was it, like Trent Reznor and Gwen Stefani melded together or something like that. And I thought, why can't they embrace me for who I am? Why does there always have to be a comparison? And even now I'm still being compared to all sorts of people. You know, we just, it's natural. People do it. I understand, but I've been in this business for so long. I just would like to be seen for me. I don't follow anymore what other people are doing and worrying about if they're competition for me, because frankly, I'm not saying this to be down on myself, but I don't feel like I'm in any kind of race anymore. I'm not, nobody in the industry gives a shit about me. So it's like, you know, I can't, everybody's heads and tails in front of me every day. So I'm just like, I'm going to be the best version of myself and I'm going to create the best songs that I can for myself and the audience that's listening. And that's what I do now. I see people every day that are talented and beautiful and young and here and there. And I'm like, good for them. Bravo. You know, we all have our journey and mine is mine. And I have to embrace it, nurture it, and not worry about what anybody else is doing.
And that would have been hard at 22 to have that sort of that philosophy, because I'm with you on that. Now I am. I wasn't in 1995.
I wasn't either. Look, I mean, I got compared to Gwen Stefani a lot. And sometimes I think, like, fuck. Do I sound like that girl? I mean, I got to be honest with you. I have all the respect in the world for her, but I was not listening to No Doubt. So to be compared to somebody that you don't even listen to is irritating. You know what I mean? Right. If somebody has said, you sound like Joan Jett, I would have been like, yeah, I listened to a lot of Joan Jett growing up. I, you know, I don't mind that comparison. You know what I mean? Right. Or Pat Benatar, you know, I love those ladies. But I wasn't listening to Gwen Stefani, and it did feel at the time like there were only so many slots for people to fill. And when those slots were filled, you were going to get dropped or left behind.
Right.
And I think it's taken over 20 years for people to recognize that I didn't just join a band on a fluke to have fun. Like, I'm an artist. I paid my dues album after album, tour after tour. And I do not have imposter syndrome anymore.
It can be cured. It can be cured. Let the listener know. It goes away. I was raised by New Yorkers, Bronx people. There's a certain sensibility. But how much of Long Island did you hear in Drill? And how much do you hear now in KMFDM? Is there a Long Island sensibility that shows up in the music?
That's a really interesting question. you know, I had three older siblings. I'm sure what they were listening to at the time was just as much an influence on me as what I was listening to. You know, as a kid, hanging out on Bar Beach or Jones Beach, listening to what everybody had coming through their boom boxes. New York was the central of where great music came from, just like Chicago or LA, you know. We were listening to, you know, WPLJ and all these independent stations. Anytime you were in a car or at somebody's house, everybody had different tastes in music. So I feel like I had a really great foundation for music growing up, between my sister listening to David Bowie and, you know, my brother was listening to Jimi Hendrix and the Doors, and my sister Karen was into Peter Gabriel and the Police. And yeah, I was a kooky kid who listened to The Cure and Duran Duran and, you know, Susie and the Banshees and Sisters of Mercy, I go crazy for. And all my friends listened to different styles of music too. There was not any one genre. And when I think about the lifestyle of growing up on Long Island and how that influenced me, I spent a lot of time in the woods, by the water, swimming, daydreaming, hanging out in trees, smoking pot, going to parties.
Sounds fun.
Well, when I was out of the house, it was fun, yeah. You know. The Long Island impact on my music, I think when I listen to music and I think of my life in Long Island, I realize how music has been the soundtrack of my life, how music is the soundtrack for everybody's life. When you think of growing up, you can pick a song for when you first fell in love and like, what was the song you were listening to that you shared with your girlfriend or your boyfriend? And, you know, all your first times and all the worst times, the best times, the worst times. And music is just, I know it's not this way for everybody, but for me, it's like a canvas that has shaped my life. And Long Island is definitely a part of that canvas. I still write about my songs about that time. I mean, on my last solo album, I wrote about some very painful moments in my life growing up. The last song on the album, No Place Like Home, about the abuse that I and my siblings lived through at the hands of my father. I still travel back to that house that I grew up in. I'm still sometimes there, not always, but I sometimes find myself there and it finds its way into the music. So yeah, Long Island is still a part of my musical journey.
When you hit the ground in New York, when KMFDM plays New York, do you feel a kind of instant familiarity of like, oh, I'm back? Or does it take a little bit to get reacquainted?
Well, there's, you know, that adrenaline rush hits me when we played Long Island for the first time in many, many years on the 2022 tour. We played the Paramount in Huntington. I woke up and before I opened my eyes, I knew that we were in Long Island because somebody had left the door open and I could smell the air. And I just, eyes open, and in my head, I just heard home. And I walked out and I just smiled because there's so many beautiful, painful memories there, but the smell, it's home. It's like in me. And when we go to New York City, so much has changed. I mean, I haven't lived there in a really, really long time, and everything is different. But we've played Irving Plaza many times before, and I lived in Gramercy Park for many years. My sister lived there with her husband. That area specifically is very close to my heart, and it's so funny. Whenever I go to New York, I think about my sister who passed, and I just posted a photo on her birthday, which was the other day, on Instagram. And she's wearing, it's a picture I took of her in Barnes & Nobles, and she's wearing this great blue leather jacket that I always loved. And when I posted that, I said, oh God, I always loved that jacket. And then the next day, my brother-in-law, who I haven't spoken to in about a year, calls me up and he's like, I saw you're coming to New York. And I'm like, yeah. He's like, I'm going to come down to Irving Plaza and see you. And I'm going to bring you something. And I said, what are you going to bring me? He's like, I'm going to bring you that blue leather jacket. So I'm going to get to Irving Plaza and I'm going to put that blue leather jacket on. And I'm going to walk around that neighborhood by myself after having coffee with him. And I'm going to sit in all the places I sat with her. And it's going to be really special.
Oh, that's so moving.
Yeah.
Ugh.
When we hit this stage in 2022 and anytime before that, and I look out at all of those faces and I'm in New York City where all of my dreams started, it's so powerful. I can't tell you. I can't even explain to you. And that room is one of our, I mean, it's not the best sound in the world in there, but people have such a good time. And it's usually my favorite show of the whole tour. I mean, I don't want to take anything away from anybody else because everybody's great all across the country, but New York is home, so it's special.
I think everybody understands that too. You know, it's like home is a different, it has rarefied air.
Yeah.
And speaking of air, there's a through line to this conversation, which I've noticed, which I love, is that there seems to be a recurring refuge in the natural world as well as art. You mentioned raindrops, the smell of the air, sitting in a tree, being outside, which probably originated with wanting to be outside of the house, right? So, but the natural world seems to hold a very warm embrace for you. Mm-hmm. Is that a fair characterization?
Yes. Yeah. I spend a lot of time outside around trees. I walk in forests. I'm fortunate to live near a lot of forests. When I was growing up, we had a summer house up in Cold Spring, New York. And I think it probably started then. We were encouraged to be outside. And during the most difficult times of my life, I would seek places in nature to figure shit out. And I still do that. And I feel safe outside. I feel like, and I know this is a little far reaching for a lot of people, but I feel very close to God, the divine, whatever you want to call it. I feel a very strong connection when I'm around nature. And I draw a lot of strength from that on a regular basis. That's my resource to kind of deal with any struggles that I have. I just go for a walk, sit under a tree or in a tree. I just draw a lot of strength from the natural world.
I think the mysteries of life and the universe, whether it's God or something cosmic or whatever, that's where it's found. It's not found in a living room. It's found out there.
You know, everybody has their faith. But for me, when I say God, I am talking about the cosmic consciousness. You know, I'm trying to keep it in a digestible bite-sized piece because I believe all paths lead to one. And that is, there's something far greater than anybody can discover in a book out there. And I've experienced some truly mind-boggling situations that have led me to believe with all of my heart that there is a source of energy out there that you can access. And my entry point is through nature.
There's a thing that it drives me crazy because I feel like it's my own thing, but I feel like to be an artist is to accept the transaction with the universe that the thing that you're chasing, you're never going to catch in a way that you can't hold it. You're not going to be able to hold it forever.
Now. I'm just getting that now.
I know. It's one of those things where remember,
I thought I was gonna
Well, if you think about pinball, where like the silver ball goes in the groove and you're just racking up points and then it pops out, that to me is art, where you get to hold it for 4 seconds and then it is elusive, it goes away again. It's a lifelong pursuit. And you get these beautiful moments where you get to hold it, feel its heartbeat, and then it jumps away. What I love of what you said about Sasha is that he gets up in the morning and continues the pursuit, right? He continues to chase it. You continue to chase it. I'm a writer. I continue to chase it. And when I hear about bands or musicians or artists stopping, I think like it almost feels disappointing to me. It feels like a concession that doesn't feel comfortable to me to hear. I feel like you should be chasing until the very end.
If you're given a gift, right? If you're given a gift, there's a reason for it. And, you know, you shouldn't be so cavalier to just like stop. You gotta keep exploring it. At least that's my perspective and my gifts. I feel like I'm just getting the hang of what I can do now. I feel like I only had this confidence when I was 20. I would have been unstoppable. And now nobody gives a fuck because I'm 53.
Well, Lucia, we're exactly the same age. And I do think we did have a certain species of confidence at 23. That was probably the wrong kind. It's more like bravado, right?
Right. Yes. 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 I had a lot of swagger. I certainly had that. I'd like to think I have more substance now, that I'm a little bit more seasoned and approachable and kind. You know, these things are important, but when you're young, you don't really think about all of that.
No, I think kindness especially is such an underrated thing to be. And maybe we just always assume people are until they aren't. But I do think that as we get older, kindness is so important.
I've bumped up against a lot of unkindness in this business. So, yeah, I feel like maybe I've reached a point now where I demand it from the people that I work with. Like I insist on things being kind and generous and gentle, and save the badassery for behind the microphone.
You got plenty of that, Lucia. Always nice to end with a little bit of laughter. How about that? Lucia Cifarelli of KMFDM. She's fantastic. She is just the greatest. We'll have her back. She's a lot of fun to talk to. KMFDM are a lot of fun to see live. Are they coming to your town? Find out. KMFDM.net is where you need to go to find out what's happening with the performance art collective that's been around
for a really long time and have no signs of slowing down. Support Lucia Ceffarelli's solo album. Go to her website, luciaceffarelli.com, LuciaCiffarelli.com. Her new solo album is being plotted and could use your support, so pop in and offer some help in any way you can. In the meantime, grab some KMFDM music. The new album, Let Go, is phenomenal. You will not be sorry. If you're working out, you're going to love it. If you're not working out, put it on. It'll make you work out. AlexGreenBooks.com is where you need to go to find out what's happening with me. You can also follow me on what's left of Twitter at X, is what they're calling it now. Just the letter X. So bold, so misleading, so confusing, so probably corrupt. At Embers Editor on that platform or on Instagram at Embers Podcast, or email me, editor@StereoEmbersMagazine.com. Visit Bombshell Radio at bombshellradio.com and subscribe to Stereo Embers, the podcast, on any podcast platform that makes you feel comfortable. You know, like the one you're listening to this on now. Rate and review the podcast. We'd certainly appreciate it. And tell all your friends. We'd appreciate that, too. Let's close the show with a longer listen to Push from KMFDM's brand new album, Let Go. Enjoy it. And thank you, as always, for listening to Stereo Embers, the podcast, only right here on Bombshell Radio.